your Buddhist youth association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
Hello and welcome to the program. On YouTube, there's a video of a man who has planned a surprise for his girlfriend's birthday. He blindfolds her and leads her through the house they share before they end up in some room that looks like a laundry. He then tells her to take off her blindfold, and she's confronted by all her belongings, packed up and ready to go. Evidently, she'd been cheating on him, and this ambush was his way of bringing home to her that she was moving out and it was the end of the relationship. Now, of course, nobody likes being cheated on, and we as audience might feel that the guy had some justification for what he did. You be mean to me, and I'll show you how mean I can be to you. It's a common attitude, even among some of us who claim to follow a spiritual path, though most traditions tell us not to behave in this way. And the video is quite a gross example of emotional ambush. But as we all know, there are more subtle ways that we can hang out for the right moment to do what will most hurt or embarrass those we have a beef with. But whether gross or subtle, it's not something one following an authentic spiritual path should even think about doing. And in the mind training teachings we've been following, one of the training slogans is, "Don't wait in ambush," which means exactly what the man in the YouTube video did. He found out that his girlfriend was cheating on him, but then bided his time until her special day, her birthday, to make her as miserable as possible. Or maybe he did her a favor and she was just relieved. Who knows? But his calculation was to make her birthday as uncomfortable as he could. The slogan, "Don't wait in ambush," appears in the text we've been going through, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, by Nam Kapel. This text and the one it's based on, The 7 Points of Mind Training, have attracted many commentators, and we've been looking at a few of them. Mostly they say the same things, but each has a unique take that may help us understand just a little bit better. Last program, we went through the interpretations of Chogyam Trungpa and his student Pema Chodron. Now let's see what His Holiness the Dalai Lama has to say. In a brief commentary, he likens an emotional ambush's behavior to bandits lying in wait on the side of the road to ambush a caravan. Likewise, he says, we need not lie in wait for someone to make a mistake or act improperly in order to pounce on them or accuse them. If we're a good person, it's easy to be good with those who are nice people, but it is the difficult ones that are the real test. And Jamyong Kontrol says something similar in The Great Path of Awakening, an easily accessible introduction for ordinary people. He says, when someone has caused you trouble, the tendency is to fix it in mind and never forget it though many years go by. When there's an opportunity to ambush the person and to return the injury, revenge is taken. Give up this approach and be as helpful as you can in your response to troublesome situations. For the kind of trouble caused by demons, don't cling to the problem, but work only on love and compassion. Now, when we think of love and compassion, we usually think of being nice, turning the other cheek, and so on. But this is not always very effective, and we may need to adopt other strategies, not intending to cause misery to troublesome beings, but limiting or eliminating the effects of their troublemaking. Marsha Beck is a martial arts practitioner, and she has a way of combining her combat training with training in dealing with difficult people. She describes it in an article which originally appeared in Oprah Winfrey's magazine O, but which I found on the CNN website, edition.cnn.com. She not so much talks about situations like the guy taking revenge on a cheating girlfriend, but more about common situations where people are verbally difficult. How, she asks, do we deal with cutting remarks, helpful suggestions, subtle or not so subtle stabs, and such like verbal ambushes? Well, the article admits that we can slink away or lose our cool, or employ Martha Beck's cleverly adapted martial arts techniques to turn the attacker's words against them. Martha Beck starts with a domestic but nonetheless hurtful exchange between a husband and his wife. Don't worry, hun, said Teresa's husband, Guy, when she failed to extinguish all of her birthday candles in one breath. A woman your age has to be in shape to make wishes come true. You just don't have the lung capacity. Guy chortled. Teresa's face turned scarlet. The rest of us chuckled nervously. We were used to Guy, to the jocular way he planted and twisted stilettos between his wife's ribs. Like most of Teresa's friends, I'd always found him just charming enough to be tolerable. But as I watched him serve Teresa's cake, something dawned on me. Guy was a mean person. He'd intentionally humiliated his wife, and he did such things often. It was like that moment in a horror movie when you understand that the rogue car, rather than simply straying off course, is actively pursuing children and puppies. I recall an urge to kick Guy in the throat, which I controlled by reminding myself that it was both illegal and difficult to pull off in heels. I was studying karate at the time, and though it didn't occur to me then, I would eventually realize that the basic principles taught at my dojo could be used to fight evil, not just in action, but in conversation as well. I think of it as martial arts of the mind, and if you're subject to subtle stabs, deliberate snubs or cutting remarks, you might find these techniques an effective defense against the guise of your world. Principle 1. Find your fighting stance. Every form of martial arts requires a fighting stance that's fluid, flexible, and centered. Standing this way makes you much less likely to lose your balance, and if someone jumps you, you can quickly duck or dodge in any direction without falling. Physical fighting stances involve balance, alignment, weight distribution, and posture. A psychological fighting stance is all about emotional balance, self-acceptance, abiding by your own moral code, something you're probably doing anyway, forgiving yourself for failing to reach perfection, this is rarer, and finally, offering yourself as much compassion as you'd give to a beloved friend. I suspect some of us need work in this department. Simply put, you must never be mean to yourself. This works because cruelty, to be effective, has to land on a welcoming spot in the victim's belief system. Guy mocked Teresa's age and lack of physical fitness because he knew she hated those things about herself. If she hadn't already believed his insults, they would have left her feeling puzzled, but not devastated. The way I was when I learned that calling someone a turtle's egg is an horrific insult in China. She would have seen Guy as the pathetic head case he was, and that may have led her to our second principle. Practice the art of invisibility. I once purchased a book that promised to teach the ninja's fabled art of invisibility. I was crestfallen to read that the first step in a technique called vanishing was wait until your opponent is asleep. The whole book was like that. Get your enemy drunk, throw dust in his eyes, thump him on the head with a wok, then tiptoe away forever. Well, I could have told you that. Nevertheless, I recommend these ninja techniques for dealing with mean people. Get away from them, full stop. Sound extreme? It's not. Cruelty, whether physical or emotional, isn't normal. It may signal what psychologists call the dark triad of psychopathic, narcissistic, and Machiavellian personality disorders. One out of about every 25 individuals has an antisocial personality disorder. Their prognosis for recovery is zero. Their potential for hurting you, about 100%. So don't assume that a vicious person just had a difficult childhood or a terrible day. Most people with awful childhoods end up being empathetic, and most people, even on their worst days, don't seek satisfaction by inflicting pain. When you witness evil, if only the tawdry evil of a conversational stiletto twist, use your ninjutsu. Wait for a distraction, then disappear. But you may be thinking, what if you're stuck with a mean family member, co-worker, or neighbor? What's poor Teresa supposed to do? Well, grasshopper, that's when the martial arts of the mind really come in handy. Principle 3. Master defensive techniques. All martial arts teach strategies to deflect different attacks. For instance, I was taught to defend against a lapel grab with a punching combination called Crouching Falcon. Follow that with a multiple kick series known as Returning Viper, and finish with a charmingly titled technique, Die Forever. Now, I prefer my own techniques, such as Silent Sea Slug, which entails lying down and hoping things improve, or Disgruntled Panda, which is mostly curling up and refusing to mate. I also learned this closely guarded martial arts secret. Although there are countless techniques, most fighters need only a few. For instance, judo star Ronda Rousey has clobbered numberless opponents using the armbar technique. Her opponents know she's going to do it, but that doesn't keep her from snapping their elbows like dry spaghetti. Each good technique goes a long, long way. The following are a few that I highly recommend in order of degree of difficulty. Yellow belt technique. Trumpet melodiously. I'm a lifelong fan of Japlish, English prose translated from the Japanese by someone whose sole qualification is owning a Japanese to English dictionary. One classic Japlish instruction, which I picked up from a car rental company, advised, when passenger of foot heave in sight, tootle the horn. Trumpet him melodiously at first, but if he still obstacles your passage, then tootle him with vigor. I borrowed the phrase, trumpet him melodiously, for your first anti-meanness technique. It's meant to nip hurtful behavior in the bud. Use it when someone, say a small child or an engineer, makes a remark that may or may not be intentionally cruel. You smell like medicine. I can see through your pants. Why don't you have a neck? You can trumpet him melodiously by saying, hey dude, that's kind of mean. Back off, okay? If the behavior continues, tootle him with vigor by saying, hey, I'm serious. You're out of line. Stop it. Practice these lines until you're saying them in your sleep with clear delivery, calm energy. Then when you use them in real life, a normal person will react by immediately ceasing all hurtful behavior, and even mean people will be taken aback by your directness. They may even begin to behave themselves. Mission accomplished. Brown belt technique, zigzag. As a martial artist, you need to get used to doing the opposite of whatever your enemies expect. For example, if someone were to push you backward, you might push back for a few seconds and then abruptly reverse and pull your assailant in the direction he's pushing. He'd be toppled by his own momentum. This is zigzagging. It works beautifully on mean people. They expect a fight or flight reaction from their victims, either angry pushback or slinking away. The one thing they don't anticipate is relaxed discernment. Scuttle their plans by zigging instead of zagging, cheerfully accepting any accurate statement they might make while ignoring their malicious energy. You can observe this technique in the movie Spanglish when a young wife, played by Taya Leone, lashes out at her mother. You were an alcoholic and widely promiscuous woman during my formative years, so I'm in this fix because of you. As the mother, Cloris Leachman nods and says pleasantly, you have a solid point, dear, but right now the lessons of my life are coming in handy for you. This response stops the daughter cold, partly because it's true, and partly because it contains not a whiff of pushback. The mother zigs when the daughter expects her to zag. The result is peace. Black belt anti-meanness technique. Wicked kind parent. If you keep a balanced stance and surround yourself with normal people, you'll eventually master the black belt skill I've named wicked kind parent. Mean people are adept at adopting the tone of a critical parent, making others unconsciously regress into weak, worried children. To use this defense, refuse to be infantilized. Instead, use the only thing that trumps the emotional power of a bad parent, the emotional power of a good one. This is what happened at Teresa's birthday party. As Guy served cake and cruelty, Teresa's older sister Wendy spoke up. Now, Guy, she said in precisely the tone Supernanny uses with kids on TV, that kind of petty meanness doesn't become you. Show us all you can do better. Guy tried to laugh, but a glance around the room silenced him. Wendy had called on her good parent energy to tap a great resource. Normal people. Kind people. Outplayed and outnumbered, Guy slunk away, leaving Teresa to enjoy her birthday. This is virtually always the outcome when a mental martial artist encounters a mean guy. If you choose the way of the warrior, it will happen for you. Principle 4. Walk the way of the warrior. Being a martial artist is a way of life. You can't use your skills in an emergency unless you practice them every day. And such daily practice may lead to unexpected adventures. You'll no longer watch helplessly as some mean guy emotionally abuses his wife, even if you happen to be the wife in question. Where your pre-warrior self would have simply wilted, your warrior self will speak up, or if you're the wife, walk away. This may require drastic changes in your life. Are you ready for that? Well, you are if meanness has pushed you to the point of anger or despair. You are if you want to be the change you wish to see in the world. You can begin today. Adopt the stance of dauntless self-acceptance. Avoid combat when possible, and practice your techniques until they become second nature. But it might be helpful to remember that it really does help to wait until your opponent is asleep. So that is a somewhat amusing account of how to deal with some of the more mean-spirited situations we might encounter in our lives. Do you think you can master some of those emotional martial art techniques? Going back to mind training like the rays of the sun, in his commentary, The 7-Point Mind Training, B. Allen Wallace looks to the American Wild West for illustration. He translates the slogan, "Don't wait in ambush," as "Do not wait at the narrow passageway," and says, picture a scene from a western or from the highlands of Tibet. Bandits waiting in ambush at a narrow pass where the victim has no chance of escape. To really damage someone, one waits until one's intended victim is most vulnerable. What we are told to avoid here is biding our time to be specially hurtful, lashing back at someone maybe weeks or months after they've injured us, whether physically or verbally. On first hearing verses such as this, we may assume that they do not apply to us. Obviously, this is meant for malicious people, and we are not among the bad guys. Perhaps this initial response is honest. Some of us may hold no grudges. If so, we need not be concerned with this right now. We have certainly practiced well in the past, either in this or previous lifetimes. Let us focus instead on problems that are relevant. But our initial response may not be very insightful. In meditating on this pledge, as well as the others, the point is to examine our past experience and try to recall, have I done this kind of thing before? What was the context? What prodded me to do it? What were the results? Do I still have this tendency? And in the present, any resentment still active should be brought to light. Am I anticipating revenge? There are ways of getting back at others more subtle than standing at the ready with a shotgun. We need to check for ourselves whether each pledge is pertinent for our present situation. But they are all worthy of clear-minded, honest introspection that does not rely on the initial response, "Who me?" Maybe after more reflection, we may say, "Well, yes, at times." This does not mean that we are evil and vulgar, but simply that we have some work to do. Now, revenge is an interesting topic. Of course, Buddhism, as we've seen, exhorts us to give up all thoughts of revenge, never mind vengeful actions themselves. Again, I think most spiritual traditions do. However, to play a little bit the devil's advocate, and also to understand what drives revenge, let's look at a BBC article titled "The Hidden Upsides of Revenge." It goes some way to explaining why we so readily want to take revenge and what we expect out of it. The article is written by BBC's feature writer Melissa Hoggenboom, and we can find it on www.bbc.com/future. It starts off like this. A tale of revenge is always bittersweet. Take the sack of Troy, as depicted in Homer's epic poem, The Iliad. When Paris steals away Helen, her husband, King Menelaus, cannot bear the injustice and seeks to attack her seducer. He brings an entire army to Troy, waging a lengthy war that kills thousands. The theme of revenge spirals through the entire narrative. When Achilles' best friend and cousin Patroclus is killed, he too seeks a reckless and bloody revenge. Revenge has been part of human behavior for almost as long as we've existed on Earth. Literature has used it throughout history, from Greek tragedies such as Aeschylus's Orestia trilogy, where Orestes wants to murder his mother to avenge his father, to Shakespeare's Hamlet. Many of us have no doubt imagined vengeance against those who have wronged us, or even lashed out at them. In the moment, it can certainly feel cathartic to do so. But what motivates us to seek revenge in the first place? Researchers are gradually getting some answers, and they're finding that revenge has some unexpected upsides. Revenge is a powerful emotional trigger that mobilizes people into action. It's this very pervasive experience in human lives. People from every society understand the idea of getting angry and wanting to hurt someone who has harmed you, says evolutionary psychologist Michael McCullough of the University of Miami, who has spent over a decade studying revenge and forgiveness. It drives crime. Up to 20% of homicides and 60% of school shootings are linked to revenge, studies show, and that must be in the United States. And it shapes politics too. Donald Trump's presidential victory, for instance, came as a result of revenge of working class whites who felt abandoned by the rapidly globalizing economy, according to an article in the Washington Post. The same sentiment is echoed by many other outlets. While the topic of aggression is well studied, its triggers include alcohol, being insulted, and narcissistic personality traits, revenge is lesser understood. It's not easy to untangle from violent behavior, making it a difficult topic to study. David Chester of Virginia Commonwealth University was initially studying aggression, but quickly realized there is often a lot more going on before a violent interaction. He refers to the emotions involved as the psychological middlemen, the thoughts and feelings that come between a provocation and an aggressive outcome. I was curious, how do you take something like receiving an insult, and how do you go from that to an aggressive response? The key, he believes, lies in the desire to retaliate. So by the nature of trying to understand aggression, I started studying revenge. When Chester looked at the causes for revenge, he and Nathan DeWall of the University of Kentucky discovered that someone who is insulted or socially rejected feels an emotional pain, and the area in the brain associated with pain was most active in those who reacted with an aggressive response. It's tapping into an ancient evolved tendency to respond to threats and harm with aggressive retaliation, says Chester. Hogeboom continues, in a follow-up study, he was surprised to find that emotional pain was intricately yoked with pleasure. That is, while rejection initially feels painful, it can quickly be masked by pleasure when presented with the opportunity to get revenge. It even activates the brain's known reward circuit, the nucleus accumbens. People who are provoked behave aggressively precisely because it can be hedonically rewarding, Chester found. Revenge, it seems, really can be sweet. The link between aggression and pleasure itself is not new. The father of psychology, Sigmund Freud, was well aware that it could feel cathartic to behave aggressively. But the idea that revenge provides its own special form of pleasure has only become apparent recently. To understand this further, Chester and DeWall set up a series of experiments published in the March 2017 Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, where the participants were made to feel rejected by being purposely left out of a computerized ball-tossing game. All participants were then allowed to put pins in a virtual voodoo doll. Those in the rejected camp stabbed their dolls with significantly more pins. This rejection test was first done remotely online and later replicated with different participants brought into the lab. In the lab version, rather than a voodoo doll, participants acted out their revenge by blasting a prolonged, unpleasantly loud noise to their opponents, who were computers, not real people, which the participants were not aware of. Again, those that felt most rejected subjected their rivals to longer noise blasts. Lastly, to understand the role of emotion in the desire to seek revenge, Chester and Duval gave participants what they believed was a mood-inhibiting drug. It was, in fact, only a harmless vitamin tablet. Still, the placebo effect was so strong that the participants who took the drug didn't bother to retaliate against the people who rejected them, whereas those who were not given the placebo acted far more aggressively. The placebo group, it seems, did not seek revenge because they believed they would feel no pleasure from doing so. Taking these results together, the team came to a startling conclusion. Not only can revenge give people pleasure, but people seek it precisely because of the anticipation it will do so. It's about the experience of regulating emotions, said Chester, and it worked. After having the opportunity to get revenge, the rejected individuals scored the same on mood tests as those who had not been rejected. This finding, however, does need to be taken with a necessary pinch of salt. There are currently no long-term follow-up studies on how revenge feels days or weeks after the act. Preliminary, as yet unpublished results show that revenge seekers only get a momentary feeling of pleasure, Chester found. Just like a lot of things, it feels good in the moment. That begins a cycle, and it starts to look like an addiction. Then afterwards, you feel worse than when you started, he explains. And that might help explain why those who seek the high of revenge fail to anticipate disastrous personal consequences. The footballer Zinedine Zidane, for instance, will forever be remembered for headbutting Marco Materazzi in the 2006 World Cup. Along a similar vein, Richard Nixon is well known for his list of foes, the goal being to screw his political enemies. And some of his dirty tricks later led to his forced resignation. The question then becomes, why has this seemingly destructive behavior persisted in our evolution if it can cause us so much trouble? The answer is that far from an evolutionary mistake, revenge serves a very useful purpose. Michael McCulloch puts it this way, although people might say seeking revenge is really bad for you, that it might ruin your relationships, for example, the fact that it exists at all is a very good thing. Its main goal is to work as a deterrent, which in turn has clear advantages for our survival. Put that in your pipe and smoke it over the next week. For now, our time is up and we have to say goodbye. Thanks for being with us, and please tune in again next time. Also, please dedicate any positive potential from the program to gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Thank you, and goodbye.
is a member of Karma, the community.